On today's show, I'm talking to Diane Watson. She's a financial advisor and author of the book She Can Prosper. Now, she helps many women sort out their finances as they get older to empower them. A lot of women born in the 50s, 60s and even 70s didn't have the opportunities necessarily to secure their finances, and now they're finding themselves struggling in later life. Diane explains how they can turn things around. But before we get started, can I ask that you give us a follow on your podcast app or Instagram? Now let's get on with the podcast. Welcome to Retirement Rebel Life After 60. I'm your host, Siobhan Daniels. Join me on a journey to meet inspiring rebels who've redefined retirement. Together, we'll explore new passions, triumphs over challenges, and discover the vibrant possibilities of life after 60. This is about living boldly, not just aging. So are you ready to rebel? Last week, I spoke to Honor Marks, who's a force to be reckoned with. She's the founder of the Magical Midlife Membership and is passionate about helping women to redefine what it means to be older and bolder. She helps women to find their inner passions and to reignite their lives in their 50s and 60s and beyond. If you've not heard our chat, please give it a listen. You can find it on any podcast platform or through my websites, retirementrebel.co.uk. Thank you, Diane, for agreeing to chat to me on the podcast, because finances for women are so important, aren't they?
They're really important. And so many women are very fearful of understanding their finances, and they needn't be. And that's really why I wanted to write the book, to show women that it's actually not as difficult as they might think it is.
Why do you think it is women are so fearful of sorting out their own finances? Do you think sort of historically it's to do with joint bank accounts?
I think there's a number of reasons actually, Siobhan. I think that a lot of girls don't think they're very good at maths, or they maybe get the message at school that they're not as good at maths as boys are. So they have this innate fear that maths equals money equals finance. So they're not going to be very good at it or very good with numbers. I think a lot of it is to do with what happens in our childhood. So a lot of the subliminal messages we get when we're little girls around the fact that money is what men manage, you know, I need to ask your dad about that, spending that money. So a lot of us get the idea that men are the people that sort money out, and it's not a girl's thing. And then I think some of it's about the relationships that we get into and who maybe controls the purse strings. So a lot of women, they kind of abdicate responsibility for that aspect of their lives and just let someone else sort it out for them, often with disastrous consequences, actually.
How did you get into finances then? What's your background? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
So my background, I'm 30 years financial advisor, but before that, I worked in public relations, and then I was in sales and marketing for a big training company. But when I was training, a lot of my clients were in financial services, so some of the big organizations, and I was very interested in it. I think also because my mother gave me very strong messages as a girl around the fact that my dad wasn't reliable with money. My father was quite a militant trade unionist. He was a contract joiner, so he was often out on strike or between jobs. So my mum took herself back to college and became a teacher and then a head teacher. So she always gave me those messages that, you know, finance is something that you should make sure you understand yourself. So I was very interested in it. And it was really as a consequence of having the children that I wanted to do something that, you know, fitted in with being a mom, but also something that I was quite passionate about. And that was how I got into it, actually.
Did you find that it was the majority were men that were dealing in finances in those days and were, you know, the financial advisors?
Yes. So when I started off, the number of women in the financial world were quite small. I mean, still relatively, I think we're about 17% of the advisor population. So we're still lagging way behind. But in those days, yes, I mean, there were hardly any women. And lots of women will say that when they used to have meetings with their male advisor, he would talk to the man and they would feel almost excluded from the conversation, even if they were the main breadwinner, which is ironic, really, isn't it?
Do you think, though, that, I mean, there's a generation of women, well, generations of women who couldn't work unless their husband said they could work? So it was hard for them to provide for themselves financially, independently, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, they weren't, you know, women couldn't have bank accounts until in their own name until in the 70s. So we've always...
Still blows my mind.
I know. So there's always been that kind of thing around men and money. But I'm not just talking about women who maybe have given up work to bring up their children. You know, I work with lots of highly successful businesswomen, women in the professions, and a lot of them still do give a lot of responsibility to their finances to their partners rather than, you know, take control themselves.
Yeah. What do you think about joint bank accounts?
Well, I mean, I'm divorced now, but I always had a joint bank account. You know, I didn't have a problem with that. Well, I didn't have a problem with it until my marriage ended.
Until you did have a problem.
Until I did have a problem, yes, for sure. I think it was my mum that said to me, well, you must have a joint bank account. But I always had my own bank account as well. So, you know, the joint bank account ran all the things that we needed to commit to together. And then I always had my own bank account as well.
That's interesting. Why was that, again, because you were keeping a little bit aside for yourself for a rainy day or just in case?
I think it was what my mum told me.
Yeah. Your mum sounds awesome.
Do you know what? My mum, when I look back now, my mum was really awesome, you know, because she was born into such a poor family. You know, there were 9 of them and she was the eldest. She made lots of sacrifices to sort of support the family. And she was terrified of being in a state of poverty. So she worked 2 jobs before I was born so that they saved 50% for the deposit on their house, you know, which is
goodness
incredible
me.
Back then.
Yeah.
She used to save all the time. I mean, my parents were very, you know, ordinary working class people, but my mum was terrified of dying and not being able to pay for the funeral. So there were people knocking at the door every week. Insurance companies that don't even exist anymore, like the Salvation Army, and they'd be, you know, she'd be giving them a few pounds. So never living beyond her means.
What, to make sure that she could pay for a funeral?
Yeah, yeah. It was quite a big thing. And making sure that, you know, we were going to be okay because, you know, Dad's work was intermittent. He was on strike quite a lot when I was growing up.
Mm. Now, The importance of providing for your future financially gives you that empowerment, doesn't it, to make decisions and when you retire for your pension age. There are a massive group of women who've been caught in the WASPI, Women Against State Pension Increases, the WASPI campaign, because they thought that they were making provisions for when they retired and when they were in the 60s. And then last minute, they got told, oh, no, you're not getting your pension at 60. You'll get it at 66.
Yeah.
What's your feelings about that?
I mean, I think it's a tragedy. I mean, I've read lots of stuff about it. I mean, I myself, I'm 65 and I'm still not getting my state pension. And of course, I was expecting it at 60. So, you know, all my cohorts, all my friends from school are in the same situation. For a lot of people, their state pension is a massive part of their security in retirement. You know, it's awful. And it's only going to get worse, actually, Siobhan, because the state retirement age will definitely increase, you know, because people are living longer and they're having to push that age back so that they can afford to pay everybody their state pension.
So when should people start thinking about making provisions so that in their 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond, they're going to be able to be financially fluid and be able to have options in their retirement, which is what good finances gives you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to encourage women and men to do is to make sure that they've got things, they're financially okay so that they've got choice. You know, if they want to retire earlier, they can do. If they want to do what you've done, which is incredible, they can do. But in order to do those things, you need to have something set aside. And it's never too early to start, really.
I mean, I was lucky that I had my BBC pension.
Yes.
And my savings. So I was able to make a decision to actually live with far less, because I was working long hours and earning lots of money and buying lots of stuff and cluttering up my life, but not happy. And I found actually I spend far less and I'm far happier. Do you think sometimes people get bogged down too much with the finances and stress themselves out thinking they need so much more than they actually do?
Yeah, I think when people are working, I mean, obviously they are spending. I mean, in some ways, it's almost to comfort themselves because they're working so hard. They want to reward themselves. And, you know, you're absolutely right. We all buy, I mean, not you now, possibly, but we all buy a lot of stuff. And some of the stuff we buy, because it makes us, or we think it makes us happy, and it's a kind of contrast to the treadmill that we're all on when we're working. You know, we need these lovely things to make it all palatable, really. And the reality is that we don't need as much.
It's a short-term fix, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, with, you know, now that we've got Amazon, you can literally click a button and the next minute there's something arriving on your doorstep. So, you know, I think we're all far more profligate than we used to be. And I think that's why people of my parents' generation were not wasteful. They put money aside. You know, they were more careful. Therefore, they didn't earn as much, but they saved more.
So talk me through, if somebody in their 20s, 30s now is thinking of, you know, they want to retire 55, 60 and not wait for their state pension age, which will probably be 80 in the future, what should they be doing?
So if they're employed, which lots of people are, they need to be joining the scheme that's offered by their employer, which, you know, every employer has to offer a scheme. And you'd be surprised how many people don't join or they opt out because they think, well, you know, that's all years down the line and I'll deal with that later.
But for a lot of people, it's they can't afford, though, even those small amounts at the moment with the cost of living. But you think they should still be doing that?
And that is a challenge. I think doing something is better than doing nothing, because you're going to get a contribution by your employer that you're not going to necessarily get if you don't contribute yourself. And I always remember, so my daughter's godfather worked his whole life for British Gas. And I always remember, and he had a lovely final salary pension scheme, but I always remember him telling me that when he started work at 16, quite a lot of his salary, it's quite a big contribution. And he didn't really want to pay it. But of course, there are professions that where there is no choice about whether you join the scheme. You just join the scheme.
Mm.
You know, years later, even though it was a stretch at the start, he said, I'm so glad that I did, because he retired at 50 back when you could. So I think the people that join final salary schemes where there is no choice about joining them, which are people like teachers, nurses, doctors, local government, they just accept.
And me, that's when I'm lucky. I mean, it was the golden ticket. When I look now at the pensions that are on offer, at least I'm guaranteed a pension every month until the day I die.
Yeah.
So, you know, final salary. I know definitely when I was in my 20s, I was a nurse for 9 years before I started working for the BBC. And I didn't give a monkey's really about pensions and retiring. And it was just so far ahead in the future. So I think really I was lucky I joined the BBC and had to join the pension scheme, because I don't think I really would have made any provision for getting old.
And I think this is the challenge now, because, you know, so many companies have closed their final salary pension schemes. I mean, obviously the public sector still have theirs. Some companies do in the private sector. But generally, those lovely schemes that meant that people could retire and you know, be financially okay have disappeared. You know, and what people are left with is something that pales into insignificance, really. But it is still worth starting. The sooner you start, the less you have to make, contributions you have to make.
I mean, all this financial advice, for me, I feel a little bit uncomfortable in the sense of there will be people out there who just do not have the finances to make those contributions. They might want to, and it will make them fearful of when they retire and when they're older, when they're in the 60s and 70s, because they have not been able to make those provisions. What can they do? How can they turn the finances around?
Well, I mean, anything that they do is better than doing nothing. So even if you're putting a small amount, maybe not even into a pension, but, you know, saving it maybe into something like a cash ISA, just trying to build something if you can. And I totally accept what you're saying, that not everybody can do that. I mean, those people that can't do that will obviously, you know, need to fall back on other things when they're older. I mean, fortunately, at the minute, the state pension is, for a lot of people, if they're a couple and they've got full state pension entitlement, you're looking at sort of £26,000 a year. That's without having done anything else. So that's not an insignificant amount of money. I mean, obviously, very few of us are ever, well, I don't know anybody as well off in retirement as we are when we're working, because obviously you can't be. But, you know, with the work that with the people that I see, I mean, I was with a client yesterday and, you know, he was saying, yeah, I'm managing okay with what I've got. You know, like you've said, people don't maybe want, they're not as frivolous with their expenditure. You know, they're much more living within their means possibly than they were when they had a big salary.
I talk to a lot of women, especially since I started this podcast and wrote my book, Retirement Rebel, who are repurposing their lives in their late 50s and in their early 60s. And a lot of them, one of their big fears, starting out on their own because they don't think they've got enough money. So they stay in situations that really they don't want to be in. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I mean, it's really important. And I know that being fearful of money, not being aware of your situation, keeps a lot of women stuck in unhealthy relationships, you know, for sure. Having said that, I think the fastest age for marriage breakdown is women over 50. You know, more and more women are deciding that they're not going to stay in a relationship that's not working for them and are being brave enough to make those decisions. So I think for anybody who feels, you know, that they want to make some changes, the first thing to do is to sit down and with somebody and understand what your situation would look like, you know, what those numbers would look like. And often they're not, you know, the fear is worse than the reality, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
You know, the reality is that they are probably going to be okay. But if they've got this big fear and they don't actually, you know, understand what's going on below the bonnet, then they often are not in that situation where they have the confidence to do that.
But I think a lot of women, like you say, that are in their 50s and 60s, that they are the high number of women now that are divorcing and going out on their own, were in those relationships in the days when they didn't have control over their finances, where they couldn't get a bank account, where they couldn't necessarily get a job without the husband's permission at some stage. So it is pretty scary to go out and actually having to be starting from scratch and learning about finances.
Yeah, I mean, that is scary. And I've done quite a lot of work over the years with divorcees, mainly women, you know, where suddenly we've had to sort of help them understand how things are going to work. I think that one of the, you know, the most important things is that you get good legal advice, because a lot of women are not really aware of what they're entitled to and what their outcomes are going to be. And often if they are aware of that, that makes them more inclined to take some action. You know, because they understand that things, I mean, you know, the rules are pretty clear. You know, if you're married for more than 7 years, including maybe a period of cohabitation, then it's a 50-50 division of assets. So it's much more favourable than it used to be back in the 90s, you know. So
yeah, when I split up, we weren't married, but we've been together a number of years and we had a child. I made this presumption that there was this common law wife. This was what we all used to bandy around and talk about. And I was thinking, you know, I'll be fine. It doesn't matter. But actually it transpired, unless we were married in those days, I don't know what the law is now because I'm on my own, but unless we were married, I was entitled to very, very little. And most of what I got, I had to prove that I'd put into the relationship. And it was a pretty scary time, because I honestly believed common law wife, you were covered, you were fine. But that's not the case.
No, I mean, in the book, we take sort of key topics. And one of my big passions is cohabiting relationships and what that means, because, you know, more and more people are cohabiting, fewer people are getting married, but there is no such thing even now as a common law wife. So women...
People still think that, you'd be surprised.
They do.
If you go out on the street and ask, so many people think there is.
Yeah, they do. And it doesn't exist. So, you know, for example, if you're living in your partner's house, most of the assets that were brought into that relationship were his. You're, you know, you're in quite a vulnerable situation. I mean, there are instances where you can make a claim for money because of financial need. But legally, you're on, you know, you're on a pretty sticky wicket. And it's really important that women understand that. It's why, you know, in some ways it's better to be married than to cohabit at the moment.
But I do know of women who have been married for years, over 30 years, and their husband's been in charge of the finances. They've just gone along with it and enjoyed it and enjoyed the lifestyle and maybe signed bits of paper sometimes that the husband's put in front of them. And then the world crashes and they end up getting divorced. And they find out that they're entitled to very little because of things they may have agreed or signed without thinking, because they were in a long-term relationship bringing up children.
Yes, and some of that at that point is around the advice that you get, and it's also around what may have gone on that you weren't aware of. So, you know, getting to understand that is really so important, because I've been in situations, you know, with people myself where the man has been very determined that he's going to try and share as little as he possibly can get away with. And so, but legally, you know, we are equal in that respect. So it's really important that you get somebody who understands what's going on to act for you and try and give you the best possible outcome.
One thing I find alarming still is that finances aren't taught in schools properly. I mean, I would have loved to have been taught just the simple banking, you know, getting out of banking accounts, savings, pensions, taxes, all sorts of things, which I've learned. I'm still not particularly good, if I'm honest, with finances. When I have it, I spend it. When I don't, you know. And I think, how do you feel about the prospect of it being on the curriculum and young people being taught about finances?
Yes, yeah, so I'm a principal partner with an organisation called St. James's Place. That's where my advisory business is. And we run a financial education programme for schools.
Right.
Because we believe that children should understand the basics of finance. And so I agree with you that we need to get children to engage and understand at a much younger age.
But do you think they would do? Because, like I say, when I was younger, I wasn't bothered about pensions and taxes. I mean, how can you make them understand that this is one of the really important building blocks for the rest of their life?
I think you've got to try and engage them in a way that they can connect with, haven't you? I'm a passionate believer in sharing stories, because I think stories are the means by which people can identify in themselves. Because numbers are not a mass, they're not everybody's cup of tea, really, are they?
No.
You know, they can appear. So, and you know, when I was thinking about writing my book and I was talking to Debbie Gilbert, who you met, you know, I said, I don't want it to be a book that's full of numbers and talks about tax breaks and tax relief and all that sort of thing, because that's not...
That's giving me a headache already.
Exactly. Exactly. I thought if we could share some really interesting stories that people could think, oh, that's I'm that person, I'm that cohabiting person, you know, or I'm that person that hasn't put enough money aside, or I'm that person, then they would be able to... And in fact, somebody did call me and say, you know, the story you told me about, and it was about co-owning a business with somebody who, you know, she said, I nearly ended up as a case study in your book.
Oh, gosh.
Because something happened and I'd thought about what you said. I think it's making it simple and understandable and giving people stories that they can connect to and relate to.
I'm just going to interrupt for a moment to shamelessly plug my book, Retirement Rebel. It's published by Vertebrate Publishers, and it's my honest account of feeling broken in my 50s and finding my happy place in my mid-60s. I got rid of my home and possessions and hit the road in my motorhome for a roller coaster ride along life's adventures. I want it to help younger women not to fear aging and older women to grab life and run with it. You can purchase a copy in most bookstores and on Amazon. Right, now back to the conversation. I think what is good about my book, says she, unashamedly plugging Retirement Rebel, but it is because it is my story, it's my truth. And there are so many women out there who say that they would love to do what I'm doing, traveling around in my motorhome and living in it. But they think, what about the house? What about the mortgage? What about the bills and everything? And to see that I have got rid of everything, my belongings and a house, and I've chosen to put all my eggs in one basket, really, and it's possible and I'm happy, it makes them think outside the box. And I think sometimes we need to rip up the rule books and think we don't need to spend the money the way we've been spending it. We don't need to necessarily stay in one place all the time. And I think that is helping them make decisions financially.
Yes.
You know, they think, oh, we need to rent out the house. No, you don't. Get rid of the house.
Yeah.
What would you say? Do you find that scary that they don't have bricks and mortar, though, to fall back on?
I mean, obviously, you know, when you do what you've done, which is incredible, and I mean, you know, I'm loving what you're doing, I follow you all the time, you know, you are adding an element of risk into your life, right? Because you're reliant solely on Dora the Explorer, and you haven't got anything else to fall back on. But, you know...
But aren't you just reliant on bricks and mortar with a house? I mean, that could burn down, or you could get subsidence, it could, you know...
Yeah, and absolutely all of those things. But generally, property over time is an appreciating asset. The problem is it's a very expensive asset because, you know, you've got your council tax, there's always jobs that need doing, you know, leaks that need repairing, all sorts of gardening, you know, there's a whole manner of cost involved.
So you end up existing because of that cost, not living.
You do.
And that's my big bugbear. That's what I'm trying to, I want to gather together a community of retirement rebels who are all giving up the bricks and mortar and hitting the road and just, I don't know, I just feel we're all bogged down with massive mortgages and it just seems sad to me.
I think, I mean, you know, you've hit a really good point there. When I've bought my first house in 1984, it cost double my income.
My first house was 10,500.
Yeah, well, I think mine was something like 16,000 and I was earning 8,500. So the multiples now are so big, aren't they?
Mm.
You know, so many people have to take on so much debt. Obviously, they take on debt if they go to university and then they take on more debt when they buy a house. And then there's all the costs because a house is an income draining asset for sure. Costs a lot of money. And people don't often factor in the fact that, you know, there's all the stuff that needs to be done to a house because they don't sort of stand still, do they? You know, over time you need to replace windows and, you know, all sorts of things that you have to do when you own a property. So for you, you've got rid of all of that stuff. All you've got to do is keep your van on the road, make sure it's roadworthy and, you know, it's going to take you from A to B.
I've just had to spend, though, £1,300 getting a new Campbell and pump and things. You know, there are still expenses,
yeah.
But the level of the expenses means that I'm able to live. I'm able to just enjoy life a lot more than, you know, I had a drain in my garden within the parameters of my garden. So I was responsible,
yeah.
You know, if that backed up from on the street and things like that. So there was always that pressure of I could have a massive bill that I'd have to pay. And now, I don't know. It's just the way I like living, really. I suppose I like that level of risk. But I just think you say a house is an asset, but it's an asset in one way, but then it's not assisting you to live your life properly. And it's because we've told ourselves this is what we need to do. This is how we need to live. Are we getting it wrong financially? Totally wrong. Can we turn it on its head?
Well, I think that in the UK, we are definitely of the mindset that owning our own home is very important. I mean, unlike the rest of Europe, where people rent. And the challenge there is that, you know, the way that you're more vulnerable as a tenant. In the UK, you have less security of tenure than you do abroad. So if things like that could be resolved, that would mean that, you know, people might be more likely to take the money out of their house. And because, you know, for a lot of people, most of the money that they've built up over their working life is in their bricks and mortar.
And most of them don't get to enjoy that because they then hand it on to the next generation. I'm wired differently when it comes to finances. And I do worry a lot of my family and friends because they wish that I had a bit more security. But it just frustrates me that I see so many of my friends, dear friends, living in lovely houses, but then not really being able to afford to do much else.
No, well, I absolutely hear you. And that is the case. You know, lots of people are saddled in expensive houses, you know, that are still expensive to run, but then you're not earning the same amount of income to be able to afford to run them. Because when you retire, you know, even if you retire on a very good pension, you're never going to be in the same situation as when you were working. That's a fact. Mm. You know, even if you've got an amazing final salary pension scheme, it's never going to be the same as the money that you were earning when you were working.
But then your expenditure isn't as much because you can batch cook and you're not getting the coffee going into work every morning. There's all sorts of things where you can recoup that kind of money. But so talk me through a best case scenario of providing for your old age. When do you start? What do you do? How do you do it?
I mean, obviously you can factor in your property. So lots of my clients will say to me, when I retire, I will be selling my house and I will be downsizing and I will be using the equity that I release to enjoy my lifestyle. So the starting point for most people is, what do I need? You know, imagine you're 60 today or 65 or whenever it is. 55 at the moment is the earliest you can retire and take pension benefits. So, you know, what we do with a lot of people is work back from what would that look like? What would the numbers need to be? Where is that money that you need to have going to come from? I mean, well, I've got my state pension. I've got some pension from here. I've got some savings. I'm going to release some money out of my house. For a lot of people, the numbers are doable. They can work towards something. I think not having a clue and hoping it's going to be okay is not a good outcome for most people.
Oh, right. That's where I've gone wrong.
You know, you haven't gone wrong because you've taken a different approach, haven't you?
Mm.
You know, you've gone off and done something that is working for you. And you, obviously, as you said, you've got the benefit of having the final salary pension scheme that you contributed to. But I think it's never too early, if you want to, even in your 20s, to say, I know I'm going to retire at this age. And this is what I think, you know, in today's money, this is what I need. And then we can work back and show you how you're going to get there, you know.
But that's an important thing. You said in today's money. And I remember in the 80s when interest rates were phenomenally high and then the mortgage rates and people losing their homes. So that's what makes me fearful. When you're putting all your security for your old age just around finances, because none of us know really what's going to happen with those finances and with the cost of living. So you can be 20 now, providing for when you're 60, and then everything's completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. But you do, generally, people have to do something.
Yeah.
Because doing nothing is not a good plan, really, is it? You know, whatever you're doing is better than not doing anything at all.
So helping women with the finances is basically empowering them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's getting them to feel engaged with their own financial situation. And with that comes confidence. You know, it makes them empowered if they're in a difficult, you know, for example, we talked about if they're in a difficult relationship or if maybe they'd like to retire sooner than they think they can, or maybe they want to go off and do what you've done. You know, that's having the information around their situation and their numbers gives them confidence sometimes to do something that, you know, they wouldn't otherwise do.
Now, you said your book's got case studies in of various women to be able to help people with their finances. What other elements are in the book that will give them the tools to be financially secure?
So the book takes the reader on an age journey. So for the different phases in women's lives, there are some things to think about. when they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s. We point them in terms of the kind of things that they need to be thinking about at that age. There is space in the book to make notes, to sort of write things in that are relevant to them. And then the case studies illustrate various things, various points, different people's situations, things that some people have done. You know, we've got one of the case studies where the girl was very determined. She wanted to retire as soon as possible and the kind of things that she did. And actually, you know, she still has a house at the minute, but possibly not for much longer. You know, and she's gone from being an accountant to being a gardener. You know, for mm-hmm. her, being able to have a choice about doing something very different was something that was important to her. You know, getting out of the rat race, really, and living a more simple life.
There are a lot of people who are in their 60s and 70s and even beyond who are finding that they're having to go back to work because they can't balance the books, the finances aren't enough. And my heart goes out to them, especially when they feel that they've provided all their life for their pension and for their retirement, and they're having to go to work. That's a difficult situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the cost of living crisis has certainly not helped, Siobhan. So, you know, a lot of people, I was just reading in the, I think it was in the Sunday Times, a lot of people retired before that happened, and now they're 4 or 5 years on and they're realizing that they can't, you know, manage on what they thought they would manage. Because obviously inflation's been higher, you know, inflation's gone much higher than it was for, you know, for the previous 15 years. That impacts on prices of everything, and people are finding that they're not, you know, they haven't got enough.
Yeah, so what advice would you give to them with their finances?
Well, I mean, obviously they need to ideally make sort of sit down, have a look at what's coming in, what's going out. And if it's not, you know, if it's not sufficient, then I guess they do have to think about supplementing their income. We've got lots of women. I think the fastest growing, so more entrepreneurs than ever are females. So women are really very adaptable. And we're seeing lots of women develop, sort of create side hustles. It's not necessarily sort of working in the traditional sense that we think of, but where they can supplement their life by sort of, you know, creating these little businesses for themselves that maybe are their passion projects.
Is that older women?
It's across the piece, really. You know, it's across the piece. I'm really amazed at how many women I've met in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years who have got all sorts of little things that they're doing on the side. Some of those women not actually working full time, but, you know, they've set up little businesses that, you know, are making a difference financially, for sure.
When we started this conversation, you were talking about your mum and the advice that she gave you and things that have stuck in your mind. What kind of an influence do you think parents have when the children watch the way that they spend money? I know, for example, I do fritter my money. I do, you know, stuff really isn't important to me. So if I've got it and I can enjoy it, I'll spend it. Whereas my daughter is a lot more frugal. She's more sensible. She's got a big mortgage and her house. You know, I think it's almost like she doesn't want to be like I was.
Well, I mean, we do definitely learn from our parents, for sure. And we can learn in a positive towards way or an away from way. So if we see our parents behaving around money in a way that we think isn't the way we want to behave, then we may set off on a different tack. You know, we may say, I don't want to be like that. I want to have a different outcome for myself. You know, maybe particularly if things were very tough financially, or if we witness our mother not being engaged with her own finances and then seeing what happened, you know, if your mother's then saying, look, you know, if you don't want to do what I did because this is what happened to me, they can be messages that make us behave differently. I think our children do, you know, they're very aware of what we do and how we behave, aren't they? For sure.
Yeah, definitely.
For me, with my mum, you know, this idea that you don't spend what you haven't got. I mean, I'm always shocked when people spend more than they earn and put it onto credit cards. And then the credit card bills are expensive and the debt's rolling up because they're not clearing it. And, you know, that was a message that was very strong when I was growing up by both my parents, you know, that you only spend what you've got. You don't spend more.
Some people, though, live their whole life on credit cards, don't they? That's the only way they can afford to live.
Yeah, it is. But some of those people, for some people, it's about buying things that you don't really need and putting them onto credit cards, isn't it? You know, people have so much stuff now, don't they?
I know. How important do you think it is for youngsters to open bank accounts?
I mean, both my kids had bank accounts when they were at school, and they both had sort of jobs that they did, and they earned pocket money. So I think getting your children used to budgeting and being responsible for their own money is important. Both my children went to uni, but they did it differently. My son was sponsored through university and lived at home, so he managed to save quite a lot of money. My daughter went to university and, you know, worked to make sure that she'd got enough, you know, enough money. So getting your children used to living within their means is quite important.
I know. I think my daughter saw me fluctuate between sort of living between my means, living off credit cards at different stages, depending where I was in my life and where we were living. I always tried to live in areas that were really good, so she went to the good schools, but that would stretch me financially to do that. But I felt it was worth it. But I then feel I made a lot of sacrifices in the things that I wanted to do in life and what I wanted to spend money on, which is now why I'm being in my old age more selfish, and it's about me and I'm spending the money on me and I'm having a good time. And I think a lot of people want to do that when they repurpose. They think, what do I want to do now? You know, where do I want to go? What do I want to spend my money on? It's all right if you've got a good pension because you've got those choices. But if you haven't got a good pension or a good income, it's very difficult in old age, especially as you've just said, the cost of living's going up.
Yeah, I mean, and we're living longer, right? So it's a double whammy. I mean, I remember when my grandmother died in 1966 and she was 66 and we all thought she'd live to a good old age. You know, that's a year older than I am now. And that doesn't feel like a good old age to me. My mother's 92. My father passed away last year at the age of 93. You know, so a lot of people are going to be longer retired than they actually worked.
Yeah. But that's the whole point for me why I'm doing this podcast, because I kind of think often we're sort of 50 plus and it's a, you know, then you're on the slippery slope. But I think those years need highlighting. We need to talk about it. We need to talk that we will be spending money for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years, maybe 50 years. And it is an important time to think about our finances, because really, I thought once you retire, you get your pension and you're sorted for your finances. But often that's when the problems start.
Yeah, because a lot of people retire with an insufficient pension in the first place. And then they're trying to eke it out, aren't they, for as long as possible. I mean, the trend that I'm seeing is that a lot of my clients are working longer, not shorter, particularly where there's a choice to do that. Obviously, we've got massive stuff around age discrimination now. So, you know, you're not able to say to people, you've got to go if people want to carry on. And lots of people that I know, you know, are still working in their 60s. Because they enjoy it, actually, not because of the financial side of things, but because they have a job that they find rewarding and they feel engaged and they like meeting with other people and they obviously have holidays and all those sorts of things. But maybe they don't work, you know, maybe they work less, maybe 3 days, 4 days a week, but they still want to carry on working because they can see how long potentially they've got to live in retirement.
Well, I've absolutely loved talking to you about the finances, and it is important. I know it's important. I do need to get my head. I'll be 65 next. It's about time I really got a grip of my finances. But before you go, there's one question which I ask every one of my guests. This podcast is called, as you know, Retirement Rebel Life After 60, and I'm a retirement rebel. So I want to ask you, when's the last time that you felt like a rebel, or when was the last time you were rebellious?
Oh, I feel I've just been on a rewilding retreat, Siobhan.
Oh, amazing.
To the Lake District. And so I went into Ullswater last weekend, which was incredibly cold. I've never done it before. I went with a group of ladies from Yorkshire, and we did meditation and we hiked up a mountain and we did all sorts of things. So that last weekend actually was the last time that I felt like a retirement rebel.
What did you feel like after you'd done your cold water dip?
I felt incredible. I felt so proud of myself because I can swim. I'm not a great swimmer. It's something I, you know, I never thought I'd ever do. And I know that, you know, lots of people are getting into cold water swimming and we see the benefits of it. I absolutely will be doing it again for sure.
Well, I bought my daughter for Christmas a cold water tub. So she's doing them every day. And I was with her for a while over Christmas. And every day we did the cold water dip. And as people know who follow me on Instagram, I'm any opportunity and I'm in the cold water, I'm in the sea. I was in Orkney a few weeks ago and I was swimming in the sea there in November. But I find it very empowering. I go to a good place. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, definitely. And it enhances the dopamine in our brain, doesn't it? So it gives us that kind of feel good factor that we, you know, that we often need. So, I mean, better to be doing that than, I don't know, something else, I guess. So, yeah, I felt really, really naughty last weekend for doing all these things that I've never, you know, done before. And I think when you're older, I mean, I personally feel very young for my age. I feel that I don't conform to the stereotypical 65-year-old woman. I'm very open to.
I need to interject there because one of the things that is important to me is you say that you don't feel old and you feel young. And I think that's the kind of narratives that we've all grown up with about we have to say we're young at heart. But you can be old and feel old because old is good.
Yes.
You don't have to put young there. And also the stereotypical 64 or 65-year-old, that's again what society is telling us, what they think we should be doing or we should look like or we should say. And we need to take control back again, I feel, and say, this is what 64 or 65 looks like. This is what we're doing. I don't need to be younger. You know, this is how we feel. We feel old at heart because old at heart is good.
No, I totally understand. I absolutely do. I do.
Because I used to say I feel young at heart. And actually, I stop myself from saying it now. Occasionally, I'll say it and I go, no, I mean old at heart because old is good.
I totally get that. And I agree with you. You know, I think there is a lot of ageism around, isn't there? Generally.
Yeah. And also, I love the fact that you went and did that wilding retreat with a bunch of women, because this podcast is all about building a community and empowering women. And everything that you've talked about today and what you say about your rebellious weekend last weekend just fills my heart, because that's what I want this platform to be, somewhere that we can all just talk and show that we're living vibrant lives when we're 60, 70, 80 and beyond.
Absolutely.
So I've got to thank you so much for joining me and chatting with me on the podcast today. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, it's been great to catch up with you again. I hopefully see you when you're back in Yorkshire.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Diane Watson, the financial advisor and author of the book She Can Prosper, just as much as I did. She'd got so many good tips about how women can empower themselves financially to ensure that they feel more secure as they get older. I learned that we need to encourage girls to take more ownership of their finances and to stop them thinking that money's something that men manage. It is changing, I know, but there's still a very long way to go if women are to feel financially equal in society. I also took away from our discussion that the rise in state pension age means that women need to think even more about getting their finances right from an early age so that they've got choices when they get old and hit their 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond. Next week, I've the pleasure of chatting to Karen Wright. She's a former Great British Bake Off contestant, and she has her own cookbook out called Meals on the Move. We talked about how life can find new meaning in your 60s, and you can actually redefine who you are when you discover the confidence to stop self-limiting and to try something new like she did. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for joining me on today's Retirement Rebel Life After 60. I'm truly grateful for your time and your willingness to embark on this journey with me. If today's conversation sparked something within you, or if you've your own rebel story to share, I'd love to hear from you. please reach out through our social media channels or email, and let's keep the conversation going. Email us on podcast@retirementrebel.co.uk. And remember, if you found value in our time together today, consider sharing this episode with a friend who might also enjoy and benefit from our Retirement Rebel community. Spreading the word helps us grow and continue to challenge the narrative around life after 60. All of our details can be found on retirementrebel.co.uk. Retirement Rebel Life After 60 is written and hosted by me, Siobhan Daniels, and produced by the incredibly talented Matt Cheney. Join me again next week for another episode. Until then, keep embracing your inner rebel and living life to the fullest. Bye for now.